it's Diane. On my mind, the 100-year anniversary of the Tulsa Massacre. It's one of the worst acts of racial violence in the history of the United States. But even those from Oklahoma and Tulsa know little about the events surrounding the violence that began on May 31st, 1921. Over the course of 2 days, Tulsa's thriving Greenwood District was decimated by a white mob. African-American property was destroyed, hundreds lost their lives, and thousands were displaced. Despite the devastation, the events were wiped from the history books. But now there's a growing movement to change that. I spoke with Caleb Gale on Memorial Day. He grew up in Tulsa and wrote this past Sunday's New York Times Magazine cover story titled 100 Years After the Tulsa Massacre, What Does Justice Look Like? Caleb, if you would give us a sense of Tulsa's Black Wall Street, also known as the Greenwood District, before the riots of 1921.
Yeah, I think, you know, most people kind of mythologize what Black Wall Street was, when in actuality, it wasn't this, you know, large, massive kind of breeding ground for Black billionaires, right? Which I think it has become somewhat sadly mythologized as. It was actually a place where people, specifically Black people, had as much opportunity to succeed as they did to fail. So for instance, the, you know, dollar earned by a Black person circulated in the community 12 times before it left it. There were people who owned their homes. There were people who were, yes, incredibly wealthy and prosperous. But for the most part, it was a place that was somewhat guarded and sheltered, we thought, from kind of the rampant amounts of Black codes and Jim Crow and what have you. But the reality was that surrounding this community was this ongoing effort to try and limit Black success in this very new state at the time, Oklahoma.
If you can, give me a sense of the geography of Greenwood in relation to the rest of Tulsa.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so to put an even finer point on it, it was called Eden of the West, right? By the Muskogee Comet, a small Black newspaper at the time. It essentially sat directly to the north and east of what we now consider downtown. So it abuts all that is the rest of Tulsa, right? To its south and to its west. And now it's more so demarcated by a massive highway that was built through it. But it was effectively kind of right there next to downtown, which a lot of the white landowners, developers, and city leaders really wanted for the development and growth of a commercial district and a railroad that would, they hoped, run right through it. So it was very residential in nature, but also quite commercial, kind of an intermix of the both. And it sat directly northeast of downtown.
And can you give me a sense of the numerical population?
Yeah, so there are roughly around like 11 to 15,000 Black people who lived in that neighborhood. Sadly, a good chunk of them, of course, had to vacate, died, so on and so forth, left homeless post the massacre.
Were they all pretty much middle class? Were there poor people? Were there homeless people? Were there very wealthy people?
Yeah, exactly. I think you're pointing to what exactly it was, where you saw Black people along all levels of the social strata, right? There were people who were living in boarding houses that were barely making ends meet. There were people who were solidly middle class. There were people who were incredibly wealthy. There were people who were teachers and doctors and lawyers. There were people who were sanitation engineers, porters, and on down the line. So of a mix and variety of people at a variety of levels of social and economic status occupied Black Wall Street.
So on May 30th, 1921. How did the day begin?
Sure. So Dick Rowland went to the Drexel building. He was a shoeshine worker, a black shoeshine worker, enters an elevator with Sarah Page, 17-year-old white elevator operator in the Drexel building. We don't actually fully know what happened, right? But it is assumed that there was some sort of tripping accident that was, of course, misconstrued, albeit intentionally. And a clerk in a nearby store reported that Dick Rowland had assaulted this young girl. The issue is that while he was arrested the next day, the relatively unfair and unbalanced newspapers, the Tulsa Tribune in particular, issued kind of a call on their front page that said "Nab Negro for attacking girl in an elevator," right? Calling for this boy's lynching. And what was scary was that though the day might have begun as a simple tripping incident, the days that followed, especially once Dick Rowland was arrested the next day, it essentially became a powder keg that was ignited with essentially the conflagration of black men trying to ensure Dick Rowland's safety.
So the jail where Dick Rowland was being held, I gather a white mob came to the jail with perhaps the idea of lynching Dick Rowland, assuming that he had made some kind of sexual advance or some sort of motion that set this whole thing in motion. But I want to know whether, if you know this, whether the person who originally called out the police was white or black.
Yeah, we believe the person was white. Sarah Page, actually, the girl who was supposedly assaulted, didn't cop to the charges or anything like that. Dick Rowland ended up living out most of his days in Kansas City. And to provide just a quick finer point on this, you know, less than a year prior, the city of Tulsa had lynched someone named Roy Belton happened to be a white man for hijacking a taxi and killing its driver, right? And so the assumption was, from the black community's perspective, now if this community is willing to lynch a white man, right, for allegedly hijacking a taxi, what more would they do to this young black man, Dick Rowland, for supposedly sexually assaulting a white elevator operator, white female elevator operator? So it was actually more so that when he was sitting in the jail, what really kind of precipitated a lot of events is that a lot of black men from Black Wall Street made their way to the courthouse to make it clear, you know, that this young man's rights would not be infringed upon. They were there just to make sure things were okay. Many of them, World War I veterans, came there oftentimes with their military issued weaponry. And what really kind of took things off was that as the night went on, a large group of black men came with military issued rifles and pistols. A white man told one of the black men, you know, "What are you doing with that gun?" Slight kerfuffle turned into something much greater. And at once, 12 people were killed at that site. And that's what kind of created a ripple effect that ended with so much death and destruction.
When you talk about the death and destruction, do we know how many people were killed?
Sure. Yeah. You know, so what's sad about this is we don't actually have an exact number. Even our estimates are off, in part because, while we assume that roughly, you know, in the Black Wall Street community, 300 people were killed, 9,000 were left homeless, many more were injured, many businesses were burnt to the ground. I mean, you know, one of the most kind of egregious acts of violence inflicted on a domestic community in the United States, we don't still know where all the bodies are buried, right? There are reports, especially during my reporting and research, where, you know, kids would attest to people's bodies being dumped in rivers. People were put into fields, to the paupers and potters fields, to be buried one on top of another, on top of another, on top of another, in what we call mass graves, that just until October, we hadn't even dug those up, October of 2020. So we don't actually have the best estimate of how many people were lost, how many white people were lost, how many black people were lost. We're going to start exhuming those bodies this week, tomorrow, actually.
Exhuming all those bodies in the mass graves that you know of.
Yeah, so they've been found, when I talked to the state archaeologist, Carrie Steckelbeck, as well as the forensic anthropologist who herself is a descendant, Phoebe Stubblefield, and then Scott Ellsworth, who runs the Tulsa Physical Investigation Committee, they were able to find what they assumed to be somewhat around 12 or so, the remains of 12 or so people in one mass grave. But we still know that there are more mass graves than what we've already found. But this is just one. So they're going to start exhuming that one kind of plot where they think they have found roughly the remains of maybe 12 or so individuals, possibly more, possibly less. So we don't actually know the full tonnage of destruction and death that was visited upon Black Wall Street on that day.
Do we know whether many whites were killed in the same conflagration?
Sure, yeah. I mean, an infinitesimally smaller amount of white people were killed than black people, right? I mean, you have to understand that the National Guard, a lot of the police, if they weren't participating in the violence executed upon black people, were standing by and allowing it to happen, right? And so, you know, while many of the black people definitely tried their darndest to defend themselves, to flee, to hide, you know, there was a significant and substantial onslaught that came into that community in an insurrectionist style to wipe out and eliminate a good portion of Black Tulsa.
And what about the destruction to property?
Yeah, I mean, they destroyed, you know, well over 1,000 homes, businesses, stores, you name it, right? I mean, at one point there were, you know, 38 places people could go for food, for groceries, for vegetables, for what have you. And those didn't exist. Now, granted, it rebuilt. The people began to rebuild as the embers smoldered. You know, people were not able to sit on their sorrows. They had to kind of get up and use those sorrows as a motivating force to rebuild the community. And rebuild they did, bigger and stronger than it was before, which we can talk about at some other point. But yes, I mean, it was significant just how devastating it was. I mean, they laid that community to waste. They raised it to the ground.
I mean, the energy, the wherewithal to rebuild had to take an incredible amount of energy.
Definitely. I mean, when I was talking to Scott Ellsworth, kind of the resident expert on this, who wrote Death in a Promised Land in his newest book, The Groundbreaking, really kind of emphasized that, like, while they mourn, they had to work. They had to continue to earn. They had to feed themselves, even though it was incredibly hard to do, right? Like, the city passed Fire Ordinance 2156, which provided all of these very specific and prohibitive ways in which they could rebuild. Buildings had to be made out of particular types of material that made it almost impossible for them to rebuild immediately. They had to fight that in court, right? So they couldn't, there was no point at which they could sit down and say, you know, this is really bad and we should kind of mourn and do nothing. They actually had to mourn and work, almost kind of the watch, fight, and pray mantra that a lot of people have taken on throughout the generations. They had to do the same. And so, you know, they fought that in court. They got the Oklahoma State Supreme Court to issue a decision to reverse that. Black attorneys did. They began to rebuild. I mean, by the 40s, the Black Wall Street was bigger and better than it was before. It was taken out and severely demolished, but severely hampered its growth was the emergence of urban renewal as a policy initiative of the city of Tulsa and many other cities around the country as the federal government released billions of dollars into our state and our local governments. But, you know, it was difficult, but they had to do it, or else they would not have been able to make it through what then became a difficult summer, a incredibly cold winter. Many of them even had to live in internment camps and couldn't even work to get the efficient plumbing that they would have needed. I mean, it was a devastating experience, but they had to continue building and rebuilding almost immediately after.
Caleb, I have several friends born and raised in Oklahoma who now live here in Washington, with whom I talked and asked, did you know about this? And one woman my own age said, I never heard one word about this until 3 years ago. Now, how is it that something as devastating as this could pass through the consciousness? How could they not have known?
Sure. I mean, it's hard and mind-boggling to believe, but I too didn't know, right? Until I was almost out of high school, didn't hear it from my textbooks, didn't hear it from my teachers. There are two reasons, right? Like, one, there was a very serious campaign of silence that as the embers were still smoldering and the fires were still dying down, that the city of Tulsa engaged in. They told the world, look, we are going to repair. We are going to reconstruct. They created a reconstruction committee. The executive welfare committee was busy in meetings. Alvin Niles, who was in charge of the Chamber of Commerce, mentioned even, you can see what he was telling the Tulsa World and Tulsa Tribune. Look, we are in hourly meetings, hourly conferences, trying to figure out how to rectify such a terrible and devastating situation. But that was all just lip service. It was lip service that they were paying to white elites who had already made their way to Tulsa, and white elites that they wanted to come to Tulsa because Tulsa was booming. Tulsa was quickly becoming an oil capital. It had massive amounts of opportunity for wildcatters who wanted to dig a well and become instantly wealthy. So you didn't want, as white Tulsa, to give the image that you couldn't control and fix your black problem, right? And so what they did was, very effectively, is that they would, in some instances, like the Chicago Tribune, try to give them money. They said, oh, no, we're fine here. They tried to give them money to help and aid people. They said, no. Additionally, there's then this fear that I kind of expose when talking to Tiffany Crutcher, the focus of my New York Times piece. She mentioned how she didn't know, and her great-grandmother had to flee. She had a business in Black Wall Street, had to drop everything and run to save her life. And she didn't know, her dad didn't know, until he was an adult coming back from Vietnam, because the great-grandmother said, look, we didn't want to put ourselves in a position where if we said too much about this, potentially that same violence, that same devastation, that same massacre could potentially happen again. And so it was both fear, but then also a real campaign of silence that drove a great deal of this. In fact, and this is the last little anecdote, First Presbyterian Church in Tulsa, right there in downtown, is noted for housing and keeping under safeguard a lot of Black Tulsans. They talk about it oftentimes, about how wonderful it is. But in a paper very soon after, about a week after, where they had, Black folks had almost been storing themselves as refugees during this massacre, they issued a statement saying, don't worry, it's all been fumigated. It's all clean. Don't worry. There's no problem here. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But that was the nature. We didn't want, and we still don't as a country, want to linger on bad things, because history indicates who we are. So if we decide to linger on a history in which we did terrible things to one another and then try to forget about it, what does that say about us today? Has much changed, right? So I think that's the reason. Fear, and then this desire to maintain silence for the purposes of keeping up appearances.
You remind me of how Republicans are treating January 6th.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, that was one of the things that I mentioned in my piece that caused a riff on the very commission that's been mandated, you know, by their own power to commemorate the 100-year anniversary. James Lankford, senator who from Oklahoma, U.S. senator, decided, you know, last minute to flip his position from trying to delay the vote, the certification of the vote, to deciding not to delay the certification of the vote, was castigated verbally, significantly by commission members for standing so close to President Trump, who likewise is trying to get us to forget it, to, or at least remember it as something far less violent, far less cantankerous, far less dangerous than it actually was. So it seems as if, I think for a lot of the people who even sit on the commission, some of whom are descendants of survivors of this massacre, felt as if they were rewatching what their ancestors had to experience by watching aggrieved, primarily white people, make their way into the Capitol because they were aggrieved about a decision that everyone agreed we had come to, right? They felt as if they were reliving it in real time in 2021.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Caleb Gale. Now here's the rest of my conversation with Caleb Gale. He wrote this past Sunday's New York Times Magazine cover story titled 100 Years After the Tulsa Massacre, What Does Justice Look Like? I gather there's one lawsuit filed on behalf of Tulsa survivors. Tell me about that case.
You know, it's interestingly not the first, but it's definitely the first of its kind. So the first one was actually filed in 2003 with the help of Charles Oakletree, famous Black Harvard Law School professor, and Johnny Cochran, of course, O.J. Simpson's defense attorney or lead defense attorney. In 2003, it got, I believe, to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. The issue was that they had some statute of limitation issues, right? So what was interesting about this new case pioneered by a collaborative legal team is that they're now pursuing a public nuisance legal strategy, which is a little different from any other kind of legal strategy because it was the same one leveraged by the state of Oklahoma when they were going to court with Johnson & Johnson for the effects of the opioid crisis being lingering and long-lasting, right? So it wasn't the usual notions of statute of limitations don't apply in the case of public nuisance when it's declared, because the notion is that it has created an ongoing effect. So with this lawsuit, what they've done is they're trying to file under similar circumstances, under kind of a motion to dismiss consideration now. I think that was filed by the Chamber of Commerce, Tulsa Chamber of Commerce, which is one of the defendants in this case. But the whole notion being that this one event had significant ongoing recurring impacts of a negative nature that are affecting people even today. So the actual lawsuit doesn't even name a dollar amount. What it does is it calls for a public and thorough accounting of what was lost, what damages have been incurred, so on and so forth, so they can fully estimate the full sum total, while also calling for the building of a hospital in North Tulsa, that area, as well as like 99-year pause on taxes, local taxes needing to be paid by residents in those communities, as well as some of those survivors and descendants of those survivors and victims.
So, in other words, a fair amount of money.
Sure, exactly.
Do you think that kind of reparation will ever really be done?
I think that the legal challenge is going to be just that, a challenge and a pretty uphill battle. I think, though, that one of the people I interviewed was a guy named Greg Robinson, who's kind of formed a coalition in the city to look at more sustainable policy solutions, because what he mentioned was, his exact words were, we're forcing the last remaining survivors to sue, right? Like we're in order to get justice, you're kind of forcing them to sue. And in his mind, you don't even need that, right? You can leverage municipal finance tools to ensure that incremental taxes are reinvested in that community. You can form community land trusts that then put in the hands of the community that's been aggrieved the decision-making power as to how to apportion and allocate finances appropriately on their own behalf, right? So there are the repertory work can be expanded beyond a lawsuit and really can encompass more comprehensive and sustainable, long-lasting policy decisions. And so I think the legal option is going to be a very tough one. I think Hannibal Johnson, who is a local attorney there and kind of a resident historian on all things Greenwood and Black Wall Street, said that it's not going to happen, right? I don't have enough legal expertise to say that, but he's pretty confident that's not going to work. Whereas I think people like Greg Robinson, while he supports the lawsuit, also believes that there's much more in the repertory or reparations quiver. There are many arrows that can be shot that have not been shot. So why not also, in addition to the lawsuit, pursue these other policy endeavors that might be just as useful?
But in the meantime, the governor of Oklahoma is making it harder and harder to even teach about the Tulsa massacre.
Yeah, I mean, he passed something called HB 1775, which is a bill not too unlike many others around the country that makes it harder to teach about the full history of the United States, along with many other things, which would also include talking candidly about race, right? And what our past has been and what effect it might even have today because of a very bastardized understanding of critical race theory. It's angered even the parts of those who are trying to remember and commemorate what happened in 1921, those who are even anti-reparations, right? Or people who are not even wanting to go that far are worried about this because it's taken so long to even get the acknowledgement portion of reparations done. Never mind atoning, but just trying to get people to acknowledge what happened, like trying to rectify the fact that I and your friends that you were mentioning had never even heard of it in school. That was a huge win for the state of Oklahoma and for many Black people in Tulsa and around the country, was just to know that our history actually exists and existed would be, you know, a huge win. And Governor Stitt, as well as many other governors, Governor Abbott in Texas, along with others, are trying to undo that very actively.
There's an article in this morning's Washington Post suggesting that Dick Rowland, the person who got on the elevator with the white young woman, the two were actually in love and planning to be married, and that the two escaped Tulsa together. Do we know how Dick Rowland himself got out of that massacre?
That's fascinating information that the Washington Post has reported on. I saw that earlier today, but really don't know too much about it and didn't report on that aspect of the massacre or its lingering effects. What we do know is that Dick just kind of, you know, lived in Kansas City or roughly in that area and passed there. But beyond that, I didn't do too much investigating into Dick Rowland and Sarah Page and what kind of pre-existing relationship they did or did not have.
She actually wrote a letter or something telling authorities that there had been no attempt at harming her. So what happened to that letter?
You know, quite frankly, as we've seen, you know, the truth oftentimes when it doesn't exceed to what our pre-existing notions are about people, sometimes ceases to matter to people, right? It affirmed, you know, this narrative of this Black man aggressing a white woman, right? Affirmed centuries of notions about the predilections and desires of Black men and their relation to white women. And so as such, that narrative took hold. And people were more likely to believe that, regardless of the truth of that letter, the truth of what happened, the truth that Sarah Page tried to convey. So, you know, to some extent, it's the least surprising thing about this entire story is that the truth didn't win the day, right? But narrative and Holcomb did.
I want to go back for a moment and ask you about this property in which these Black people, many of them entrepreneurs, many of them successful, many of them sitting on property that white Tulsa would have liked to have. In your research, was there any indication that the Tulsa massacre was an excuse to defund and depopulize Greenwood?
If it was not intentional, it was quite convenient, is what I would say. You know, the mayor of Tulsa at that time, T.D. Evans, very explicitly, you know, mentioned, look, this is high time for us to kind of, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, to kind of speed up our plans for making this a more commercial. He even said it's more, you know, useful for industrial purposes than it is anything else, right? So kind of move, as he said, let the Negro be placed even further north and east, right? It was assumed that this was maybe not, if it's not intentional, again, it was a convenient opportunity in their minds to do so. And if you even look today, even parts of the most thriving parts of Tulsa, the parts of Tulsa that are heralded as talent recruitment tools, like come to Tulsa, right? Help us reduce our brain drain, are actually historically part of Black Wall Street, right? So parts of the arts district that are very popular are actually parts of Black Wall Street. And quite frankly, because of the construction of the highway, which, you know, kind of obliterated good portions of historic Black Wall Street, a lot of residential areas, because of urban renewal, a lot of what was formerly there is gone, right? Which has then hurt their chances of making that district, the Greenwood District, eligible for a nomination on what's called the National Register of Historic Places, which I've also written about. And that really actually is a gateway for unlocking something called the Historic Tax Credit, which federally provides a 20% tax credit. And then in Oklahoma, there's an additional 20%. So almost all of the neighborhoods and districts that surround Black Wall Street and Greenwood have gotten this because their historic integrity and significance has been carefully maintained, been more easily kept intact, because there was no highway that went through it. There was no urban renewal that gutted it, right? So those communities have seen radical, you know, upstarts and upshoots of development. I mean, they've been completely and totally transformed, so much so that I, as a Tulsan, don't ever recognize some of the very neighborhoods that I was told not to go to, in part because they were hollowed out before and are populated and vibing and exciting now, right? Whereas Black Wall Street, because of its devastation, its ongoing destruction, has been completely and totally left out of that development prospect.
I don't know if you've had a chance to watch any of the series, be the Underground Railroad, but it puts me in mind of the piece of land owned and operated by freed Black slaves who have purchased a portion of land and created a beautiful, successful winery, and about which the whites are very envious and find a way to take that back by assassinating, literally assassinating, all of the Blacks who owned and worked that farm. And here you have, I mean, they owned this property, did they not?
For sure. Quite a few, right? I mean, not every Black person owned land, but quite a few of them did. And far more than we can say today in that same neighborhood, right? Where there is a persistent food desert. We just celebrated in Tulsa. I wasn't there for it, but we just celebrated, you know, after almost a decade, the first fresh grocery store in the neighborhood. We have Black people in Tulsa living roughly 6 years less than the average Tulsan in Tulsa County. You look at where Black Wall Street is, right? This place that once stood tall, that was the signal and harbinger for potential opportunity for Black people in America. And on average, they're living in that zip code 74106, which occupies most of Black Wall Street, or encompasses most of Black Wall Street. People are living 11 to 14 years less than some of our wealthier zip codes in Tulsa, Oklahoma, right? The disparity is significant. You can trace it back almost in a perfectly linear fashion to what happened in 1921.
Who is Tiffany Crutcher?
Sure. Tiffany Crutcher is the twin sister of Terrence Crutcher, who was an unarmed Black man on September 16, 2016, whose car was broken down the side of the road. In North Tulsa, just minutes from Black Wall Street, where their great-grandmother once had a barbecue pit, self-employed, entrepreneurial Black woman. He was gunned down by Betty Shelby, who was a police officer at the time. She was acquitted, and not only was she acquitted, she received back pay. Not only what she did, she received back pay. She's now working in Rogers County, which is a county right next to Tulsa, where she serves as a deputy there. And even more than that, she has lectured to other police departments as to how to deal with trauma and difficult circumstances.
And on what charges was she shooting at Tiffany Crutcher's brother?
None. There were none. There was nothing that he had done that was illegal. His car had stopped on the side of the road. He was coming from a class at Tulsa Community College. And what I would say is, in terms of defining Tiffany, she's not just defined by that. You know, I think, you know, she's a clinical physical therapist. She's a doctor. She left behind her practice, her thriving practice in Alabama, to come back to Tulsa and has become the persistent thorn in the side of the city and its police department and many other divisions, because she is relentlessly pursuing justice. Not just for her brother, but for the countless Black people who are subjugated to less than fair, less than equal, less than equitable circumstances and treatment.
And how much of a role do you think Tiffany Crutcher will play in this repair process?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's critical, right? I mean, her story, that end to end, you know, her great-grandmother experience injustice and the same state-sanctioned violence that sent her grandmother to Kansas City because she couldn't stay in Black Wall Street because of the dangers that she was at risk of experiencing ongoing. It's the same state-sanctioned violence. This is me quoting Tiffany. It's the same state-sanctioned violence that killed her brother, Terrence Crutcher. I think it's really hard for city leaders to stare at her in the face, for county leaders, for police officers to stare her in the face and say that justice has been served, right? I think that's the hard part. And I think she makes it harder for them.
So, Caleb, how do you see this story playing out?
Yeah, you know, I think actually there's more hope than I would have anticipated. I think I have a tendency of writing pieces that don't necessarily inspire that much hope. But meeting with people like Tiffany Crutcher and others who are so active in this, who have actually captured what seems like the moral imagination of a lot of leaders, right, in the community, I think there's an opportunity to do more than just this history museum. I think there's an opportunity really to hopefully inspire people to not just acknowledge, but then think carefully and creatively and innovatively about what repair looks like.
And perhaps reparations?
Exactly, right? I think when I say repair, I think, you know, restitution, reparation, repair, they all, I think, occupy the same space in my head for me, which is to say that through city policy, through legal suits, through our educational system, through the curriculum that we use, I think it's an everything and the kitchen sink approach that needs to be taken, right? If people ever want to see any sort of reparations, because, you know, to be perfectly honest, we know for sure that all of these things exist in political dimensions, right? And so as such, there's going to be some negotiation. So if you don't bring everything plus the kitchen sink, right? If you don't, it's kind of like in negotiations. If you don't start really high, you're going to ultimately end with something even lower than you could have even tolerated. So I think to some extent, you know, going for everything plus the kitchen sink is the only way potentially to ensure that these survivors, right, can live out the rest of their days, knowing that justice has to at least some extent been served.
Caleb, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you for making the time, Diane. I really appreciate it.
That was Caleb Gale. He wrote this past Sunday's New York Times Magazine cover story titled 100 Years After the Tulsa Massacre, What Does Justice Look Like? And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.